Welcome to Signs of the Times, a look at recent world events from around our kitchen table.
The poet Shelley wrote that, in the rapacity that the Industrial Revolution created, people first surrendered their minds, or the capacity to reason, then their hearts, or the capacity to empathize, until all that was left of the original human equipment was the senses, or their selfish demands for gratification. This quote comes from an article we had on the Science page way back on August 2nd, 2004. The article was entitled Learning to be Stupid in the Culture of Cash, and it was written by an English teacher at what she describes as a third-tier American university, and she teaches a world literature class, and she remarks that a junior basically openly admitted, "I don't read," without the slightest self-consciousness, as if this was a perfectly normal thing for someone attending an American university. The author then continues on to describe the class that this student is in. She writes, "The novel she has trouble reading is Isabel Allende's Of Love and Shadows, set in the post-coup terror of Pinochet's junta's Nazi-style regime in Chile, 1973 to 1989. No one in the class, including the English majors, can write a focused essay of analysis, so I have to teach that. No one in the class knows where Chile is, so I make photocopies of general information from World Guide surveys. No one knows what socialism or fascism is, so I spend time writing up digestible definitions. No one knows what Plato's allegory of the cave is, and I supply it because it's impossible to understand the theme of the novel without a basic knowledge of that work, which used to be required reading a few generations ago. And no one in the class has ever heard of 11 September 1973, the CIA-sponsored coup which terminated Chile's mature democracy. There is complete shock when I supply U.S. declassified documents proving U.S. collusion with the general's coup and the assassination of elected President Salvador Allende."
Well, the fact that the students were unable to find Chile on a map brings up a video that was forwarded to us today of some Australian journalists doing some man-on-the-street interviews in the United States, and they had a map of the world, and they were asking people where the United States should attack next in the war on terror, and they had, in some shots, they had a map where Australia was labeled Iran. In other shots, Australia was labeled South Korea. In one, it was France. And people would say, well, I think we should attack Iran next. And so they'd give them a little pin to stick in the map, and the people would be there trying to find Iran on the map. And finally, they'd see, you know, Australia with Iran written on it, and they'd stick it in Australia, and if it was North Korea, then they'd stick it in North Korea, which was really Australia. So there is a serious problem with education in the United States, and it's a problem that really gets to the heart of a lot of the things we talk about on the Science pages, because if you don't have a critical mind developed from education, how are you able to make sense of what's going on in the United States or in the world today? The Bush gang have been telling so many lies for so many years, and it just seems to pass right over many people's heads. They seem to be incapable of looking critically at it. There's a very interesting work called The Underground History of American Education, written by John Taylor Gatto. And in the book, he cites a National Adult Literacy Survey that was done in 1993. And the conclusions of this are that 96.5% of the American population is mediocre to illiterate where deciphering print is concerned. 96.5% of Americans are incapable of reading print, of writing, of making sense of what's going on in the world around them, other than if it comes across the waves on Fox News with a lot of fancy graphics. This is a serious problem. Further on, Gatto talks about what the purpose of American education is, and he cites a book from 1918, Alexander Inglis's Principles of Secondary Education. Inglis has a lecture hall named after him at Harvard University, and he was a very prominent figure at the time in American education. What is interesting is he explicitly suggests that modern industrialized compulsory schooling has its goal to make a sort of surgical incision into the prospective unity of the working class or the underclasses, to divide children by subject, by age grading, by constant ranking on tests, and by a lot of other more subtle means. And he lists 6 points that go to underline this. The first is that modern American schooling has an adjustive or adaptive function. Schools are to establish fixed habits of reaction to authority. This, of course, precludes critical judgment completely. It also pretty much destroys the idea that useful or interesting material should be taught. There's a second, which is the integrating function. Gatto says that this might as well be called the conformity function because its intention is to make children as alike as possible. And why is this? It's because people who conform are predictable, and this is of great use to those who wish to harness and manipulate a large labor force. The third function is a diagnostic and directive one. School is meant to determine each student's proper social role. This is done by logging evidence mathematically and anecdotally on cumulative records. It's your permanent record. The fourth is a differentiating function. Once a child's social role has been diagnosed, children are to be sorted by role and trained only so far as their destination in the social machine merits. After, you have the fifth selective function. And In this, schools tag the unfit by giving them poor grades, remedial placement, and other punishments. And this sets up a social barrier between the students who have been marked this way and the students who are doing well. And so the classes are divided. And the final function he talks about is what he calls the propedeutic function. And in this is where certain students are then selected from the ones who conform, who meet the rules, and these are the ones who will be taken up to become the future managers. So what's interesting about this is that the American school system has been consciously formed and shaped to produce a certain kind of a product, and this product is essentially a sheep, somebody who will listen to orders, follow orders, and unquestionably do what they're told. We certainly see in the America of today where this has led. 96.5% of the people can't deal with the printed word. You have a president who can lie and not have any consequences to that lying.
Well, the analogy of a sheep is very applicable and very apt for the situation that you're talking about, because I mean, if you think about sheep, sheep and any kind of cattle really are herded by humans. They're fed and catered to, their essential needs are catered to, but ultimately they're used either for food or for their skins. And the thing is that sheep go through this process day after day after day. You know, every time shearing time comes around, every time it's time to produce more burgers for the human population, the cows do not learn. They have, you would think they have ample opportunity to see what happens to them, but every time they just go straight back into the sheep dip, or straight back into the slaughterhouse and go to their deaths. And so in that, I mean, that doesn't bode very well for Americans, and I suppose, well, I don't know if we should present that as a literal analogy or something that may actually occur, but the fact is that, for example, today or yesterday, that's the 6th or the 7th of October, Bush came out and made a speech stating that the United States and our partners have disrupted at least 10 serious Al-Qaeda terrorist plots since 9/11.
Way to go, guys.
The New York Times actually followed this up by saying that the listing, which was produced hastily several hours after Mr. Bush's speech, also included some previously known cases, including the one that led to the arrest in May 2002 of Jose Padilla, who intelligence officials say was exploring the possibility of setting off a dirty bomb in an American city. And it was not immediately clear whether other items on the list represented significant threats. So the fact is that Bush has come out and claimed that 10 serious Al-Qaeda terrorist plots have been stopped since 9/11, and providing no information or no details whatsoever of those plots. And in fact, the one case of Jose Padilla, charged with anything, and in fact he was not charged with setting off any kind of or planning to set off any kind of a dirty bomb. He was actually, it was alleged that he was thinking, and think about that expression, it was alleged, it's not actually clear whether it's true or not, that he was thinking about conspiring to blow up some apartment blocks in the US via using natural gas somehow or other. And to this day, he remains imprisoned, no charges have been filed against him, and no evidence has been produced to show that any of the allegations against him are actually true or anywhere near being true.
And this is an American citizen who's being held this way.
Just carrying on with, interestingly, after that claim by Bush of 10 serious Al-Qaeda terrorist plots, the unfounded claim, a few hours after, there was another story released by the Pentagon. They claimed that they had they have a letter from Al-Qaeda, written by Al-Qaeda's second in command, Al-Zawahiri, to the Al-Qaeda's alleged leader in Iraq, which is Al-Zarqawi.
The mythical.
Exactly, yes. The problem, again, like the 10, the claim of the 10 plots that have been stopped since 9/11, they now claim that they have a letter written from one Al-Qaeda leader to another. And it was actually released by the Pentagon spokesman Brian Whitman. Described the letter as written by Zawahiri, the number two Al-Qaeda, allegedly, who is, you know, Osama bin Laden's right-hand man, written to Al-Zarqawi in Iraq. He said that the United States considered the letter authentic, but refused to say how, when, or where it was obtained, or by whom, in order to protect sources and methods used. Which is very interesting. They produced this letter in Arabic that no one's allowed to see, no one's allowed to know where they got it from, or how they procured it, or how they know that it's actually authentic or not. They just say, we believe it's authentic. He described the letter as recent, but was not able to give any more details. So just to make the point, the letter, as it's claimed by the Pentagon, states that Zawahiri, that's Al-Qaeda number two, the guy with the glasses, you know, he looks a bit like Mr. Magoo. He says that he opines that the insurgents in Iraq should avoid, this is part of his strategy, the insurgents in Iraq should avoid using tactics such as bombing of mosques and slaughtering of hostages in order not to alienate the masses. That's like an amazing revelation from this grand kind of strategist, Al-Qaeda strategist, who's saying to, this is the Al-Qaeda leader saying to, or Al-Qaeda number two saying to his top man in Iraq, to not kill the Iraqi people who you are allegedly fighting for. You know, don't kill your own people, because that might not be a good idea. He continues on to say that, Zawahiri says that they've lost many of their key leaders, and that they've virtually resigned themselves to defeat in Afghanistan, and that the lines of communication and funding have been severely disrupted, which is really nice of him to say that, because it backs up exactly what Bush is claiming has been happening in Iraq. Basically, this letter, allegedly from an Al-Qaeda leader, is backing up everything that Bush is saying about how the war in Iraq is going, which is really nice of him to do that, you know, because...
It was very nice.
And
the way Osama came in and gave the last minute campaign endorsement to George Bush last year.
Yeah, these are just examples.
These are very cooperative terrorists.
Yes, yes. You'd almost think that they were working for the Bush clan, you know. But that's obviously
and
totally
that
ridiculous.
That letter comes out on the same day that George Bush is talking about all the progress that's being made in Iraq.
Yeah. So you know, it's just. I mean, you know, he. Really, we have to conclude that there is some kind of a deal going on here between the two, you know, that they have agreed to further some kind of an agenda.
Karl Rove may be writing their letters.
Henry, come on now, like, you know, we're not into conspiracy theories here. That's just one of the most scurrilous conspiracy theories I've ever heard, that Karl Rove would ever concoct some kind of a fake piece of propaganda that furthered his own political agenda? Are you joking me? Come on. That just doesn't happen in politics. It's never happened in politics.
You're right, Joe. I just don't know what I was thinking.
But yeah, but so the point is that, you know, we're just trying to highlight just how ridiculous the situation is getting. And we're just wondering how much more ridiculous it has to get. You know, we still have some faith in the American population, or at least a section of them, to, you know, when Osama bin Laden finally appears and, you know, he pulls off his beard and his turban and his Arabic dress and it's actually Karl Rove underneath, we're hoping that the American population will kind of go, hang on a minute, there's something not right about this picture. So the thing about this is that, and getting back to our discussion about Americans being unable to really see fact from fiction or see truth from lies, it's really perplexing. We need to find a solution, or maybe not a solution, but at the very least an explanation as to why this is the case, because Americans and the world population has more than enough evidence to prove to them conclusively that the Bush administration lies quite frequently about various things, most specifically about the details of the war on terror. And we just have to go back to the claims about Saddam and his weapons of mass destruction. At this stage, that there, it's pretty clear that and conclusive that they were all completely fabricated. That Bush and his cohorts, Karl Rove, his chief spin doctor, basically just made stuff up. So why would anybody, with that information that they make stuff up about the war in Iraq and tell blatant lies, why would anybody now believe anything that these people say about the war in Iraq, especially when the information and the details they give are so sketchy and so dubious, and they refuse to give any further details about any of it? I mean, it's so bloody obvious that it just beggars belief as to why anyone would put any faith in it whatsoever. And really, the answer to that probably goes back to what we've been discussing here about the US schooling system, which is that this is the problem at the core, or one of the problems anyway. There may be others. Henry's going to tell us what they are, or Scott is.
The US education system especially is rather insidious, because of course you have the lower class, if you will, for lack of a better term, who don't have access to a good education and therefore aren't able to critically analyze, forget about, you know, great works of literature. I mean, if people are unable to read a newspaper and say, well, you know, and think critically about it and analyze it and do their own research and be driven to think about it at all, and of course you have this class of people who will obviously be easily hoodwinked, I suppose one could say. And then of course you have the quote unquote privileged class, who they have, you know, perhaps they do have the capacity to at least in terms of literature, and they may know where a few countries are and, you know, this sort of thing, but of course they're not going to want to delve into what's going on the planet, what's going on in their own country, the war on terror, because, of course, they have privileges, and, of course, they don't want to give them up.
Well, there's an entire educational system in the United States for the rich. the system of private schools that cost many, many, many thousands of dollars every year, not to mention the Ivy League universities that can cost something like $20,000 a year.
And even the people who don't go to the sort of fancy pants universities, and even if they aren't rich, you have a huge middle class. Of course, it's kind of shrinking now. The gap between, as the U.S. economy continues to decline, the gap between the haves and the have-nots is increasing.
A point I'd like to make to our American listeners is that in most of Europe, university education is funded either completely or to some extent by the state, which means that higher education is open to anyone who can kind of pass the grade. Once more, we have some guests with us today. We have Erica and Dave from Hawaii. We have Chuck from British Columbia. And we have Jonathan from the UK. And we've been talking about education in the U.S. Erica has a couple of children, and she's a certified teacher, and she's decided to go the route of homeschooling. She's also read quite a bit on the question of education in the U.S., and this is one of the reasons that she decided that she wasn't going to let her kids go into school.
Getting back to what you were talking about with the sheepish aspect of the compulsory schooling, John Gatto makes a good point about how it's a pressure cooker for psychodrama, that children are gathered into groups by compulsion, and that it creates a pecking order and soon malice and mockery and intimidation of the weak and envy emerge, and a whole other range of nasty characteristics. And
that kind of sounds like a Marine Corps to me.
Or a microcosm of American society.
No, but yeah, it does. I mean, it sounds like they just transplanted those ideas into the malice and mockery and all that kind of stuff. That all seems like a real central part of the way that the boot camp, in the U.S. Marine Corps, which probably isn't that different from, to some extent, from some of the U.S. schools, you know what I mean? I think there's...
But what I found in my observation, and I volunteered for several years without being a paid teacher, and so I was in a little bit different perspective to observe what was happening with the relationship between the children and the teacher, was that certain children are, like you said earlier, kind of chosen to succeed, and the other ones just kind of fall to the wayside. And if you are a child that is creative or artistic or maybe has a little bit more energy, then you're automatically labeled and kind of categorized and placed into a certain category, and that depends on what type of attention you get later on. And so in my own personal experience, I saw children that really had the potential to learn but needed a little bit different approach were kind of pushed aside to the ones that were good followers, that could follow directions, that could do what they were told, that kind of did what the teacher asked and didn't ask questions. And what I saw in my children was that they were a little bit more artistic, and they had different ways of learning, and that wasn't really suited to follow along. And so I took it upon myself to study that, and came to the conclusion that I was doing them a disservice by allowing them to be in that environment, and it was actually harming them emotionally, and I needed to do something about it.
Well, yeah, if more parents are of American children took that kind of a responsible attitude, then certainly we might have a lot more people in the U.S. who were able to understand the more complex nature of politics and the politics, essentially. I say politics because it's politics that influences all of our lives, you know what I mean? It's the policies that are enacted that essentially create and mold society, essentially.
The homeschooling movement is, as I understand it, a lot of the momentum behind the homeschooling movement came from Christians. And so, in fact, it just becomes substituting one indoctrination for another, where the Christian families didn't want their children to be in the public schools because it was secular and God was not being taught in everything, and so they felt the need to get their children away from this wicked environment and to protect them. But you're saying, you're coming from a completely different approach.
Yes, basically it was, you know, we're all taught that you go to school to learn how to read, and that seems to be the most important function. But really, that's not the function at all, because as we can see, the reading is diminishing more and more. It's changed from a phonics-based reading system where the children learn the sounds for letters to a whole word recognition, which is basically memorization. And in Gatto's book, he talks extensively about how reading gives you a sense of personal independence, that you can formulate your own ideas, that you can question and challenge and ask questions about what's being presented. And I really feel that that's what's being eliminated. It's basically rote memorization of facts and figures and no creative divergence from that.
Which certainly serves the needs of the elite that rule the country. They're making just little machines that are going to come out and be the cogs in the larger machine.
Well, exactly. If you create a, what you're talking about here is creating a citizenry that, as you say, don't have any independence in formulating their own views and their own understanding of the world, and they are forced then just to simply look to these people that they've been told are their leaders for that view, for that view of reality and view of what's actually happening in their country and in their lives and in the world. And, you know, again, it gets to the fundamental, the other fundamental problem is that, you know, you have this group of people, politicians, who essentially are part of political families that carry on from generation after generation, and they're schooled in the same ways. And as we've often said in the past, or not so much as we have said, but the maxim that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So it's a real problem. And the other problem, of course, is when I mentioned if there were more parents like Eric in the US, then maybe things wouldn't be quite so bad. But the problem is that a lot of parents in the US have been brought up in the same, or been brought through the same schooling system as their children are being brought through now, so they see nothing wrong with it, or what can they say about it, you know? So it really takes an independent mind, and that gets down to, I suppose, just a difference in, I don't know, it's a fundamental difference in people, I suppose.
And it's also a question of economics, because if you have both parents having to work to put food on the table for the family, then
put food on the children, you mean?
To put food on their children, food on the family, as dear George so well put it, then there isn't anyone at home to be able to take care of the children and to homeschool them.
And now, like Henry said, with the religious homeschooling movement has been around for a while, and now I think what's happening is people are starting to realize that maybe they could do a better job. Their child is not succeeding, and they've tried endless tutors. They've spent thousands of dollars and nothing's working. And, you know, I think the initial thought is to doubt yourself, that you're not able to do it, that what could I teach my child? But what I'm starting to see in my own community of creating homeschooling is that you want to question things like television. You want to question the media. You want to teach your children that young, because if you don't, then they're going to fall into that same trap and they will doubt their own capabilities to question.
Are there other families that you know in the area you live that are doing the homeschooling as well?
Yes. Well, Hawaii is notorious for not having a very successful education system. And so out of desperation, people are pulling their children out of school. And like you mentioned, the economic aspect, some families have just learned to cope. Either they have a home business and they take, you know, essentially 2 to 3 hours a day is what it requires of working one-on-one. It's not that much time. It's just a matter of scheduling. Some parents work nights. Other parents get together and they do a communal type of organization where each parent has one day out of the week, and children learn to work together, and they learn that, you know, learning is constantly happening. It doesn't just happen between 8 o'clock and 2 o'clock. It happens in every moment, from working in the yard to grocery shopping to, you know, going to the doctor. It's basically learning common sense and how to integrate those common daily routines into a learning experience.
So we just want to take the focus out of the U.S. for a minute, because we have Jonathan from the U.K. here. And, you know, we just want to maybe get your views on the state of education in the UK, and if it's in any way similar to what we've been discussing here about the state of education in the US.
I think it's becoming increasingly like America, certainly with Tony Blair's love affair with America, which is for many different reasons, I think, but you do see a massive change in education, certainly because Tony has always been in love with corporate America. So you see in schools a much bigger reliance on advertising. Textbooks are sort of have adverts in them with corporations. You've got a lot more emphasis on, if you like, mathematical, logical education, rather than what you could be termed as holistic education. It seems to be going backwards. There's no sort of emphasis on multiple intelligence, if you like.
But I mean, is it as bad as is being stated in the U.S. in terms of when a 16-year-old kid leaves school, are they their writing and reading extremely poor?
Absolutely. It's still much, much better in Europe, and certainly in the UK. It seems to have a long way to go before it gets to the levels of America. But you can see it creeping in. You can see this corporatism creeping in, certainly. But there's many more years to go before you get to the extreme levels that we can see in America. I mean, but it would be foolish to say that Europe is whiter than white in that respect. But I think just as Tony Blair has an agenda, it covers the education system as well. And of course,
although one of the problems is that if Tony Blair or any other European leader who say was to support Bush and was trying to get on the same page as Bush, they don't have the years of preparation and the years of this kind of a dumbing down in place.
Exactly.
Because they're kind of coming to it a little bit late in terms of trying to ensure that people can't think for themselves, because certainly it's too late at this stage. Because
I mean, essentially, I think it's even if Europe was to get to the levels of America, it's still going to be fundamentally about creativity and the lack of creativity that is so apparent. And you were I think it was Henry who was talking about the fundamental question seems to be of perception. I mean, there are many different types of education in England, alternative education, for example. There's the Steiner schools, there's the summer schools, but they are completely isolated. They're for privileged families with a lot of money, and they are little blips in the system. So in that respect, it still seems to be attached or connected to a fundamental way we view life, how we perceive life. So in a sense, I'm very extremely skeptical as to how you change that perception, how you educate a child within a system as it stands. So it seems to me that there needs to be a huge collective change for a true education to come to pass. But I certainly don't know how that might be.
What about if we just clean the slate and start it again?
It certainly seems to be going that way, doesn't it? Or does it?
Well, this one's been messed up, you know what I mean? It's just like, this is like a, you know, the Petri dish has gone awry a little bit, you know, it's just not working. I say we dump it out and get a new one.
I think Dave has a bumper sticker that sums this up pretty well. What was the bumper sticker you were mentioning?
So many people and so few comments.
Yeah, well, you know, we don't want to anticipate. You know, there may be one for each of us.
Well, like you were saying, too, about the financial aspect of American education is they constantly state they need more and more money. And so the corporate world is stepping in, and they are starting to produce curriculum. You know, McDonald's is one. You know, Johnny has 5 McDonald's French fries, and he eats 3. How many are left?
Oh, my God.
And you start to wonder where the line is drawn, you know, between selling out to make a buck, and, you know, how really most children learn to read in less than 30 hours of individual instruction. So all these excess books and, you know, corporate sponsorships is just a moneymaker.
Well, you were talking before we started the show about the question of funding for American education and pointing out some statistics as to the deterioration of literacy in the United States at the same time as money was being poured into the system. So it seems that money isn't really the issue.
No, not at all.
Does Halliburton make school books?
back to John Gatto's book, he writes, do you think class size, teacher compensation, and school revenue have much to do with education quality? If so, the conclusion is inescapable that we are living in a golden age. From 1955 to 1991, the U.S. pupil-to-teacher ratio dropped 40%. The average salary of teachers rose 50% in real terms, and the annual expense per pupil, inflation-adjusted, soared 350%. What other hypothesis, then, might fit this strange data that I have about to present?
And we began by talking about the survey that was done in 1993 that, once again, this figure of 96.5% of Americans that can't deal with the printed word correctly, but they're pouring all of this money into it. So there's something fundamentally wrong, and I think one of the points that Gatto makes in his work is that, no, it's not something is fundamentally wrong. The system is doing exactly what it's supposed to do.
Exactly.
And that's what's really scary, because when you start looking into how it was organized, you go back decades and decades and decades to the beginning of the 20th century and even earlier, and you see that things were set up. And if you're conspiratorially minded, as some of our listeners might be,
never.
Then... And you look at history, you see that there might be reasons for this, and that this was all set up in the last century just to bring us to the point where we are today.
And if it wasn't, then why are we at the point that we are at today? Can someone give us a better explanation than someone made it happen?
Well, I suggest that, you know, not everyone can be a doctor or a lawyer. They have to have a working class. People have to, you know, be willing to be a janitor and be willing to work at a minimum wage job and be willing to take orders and not question.
Yeah, but I mean, there are people who would not be happy being a lawyer or working in a bank, for example, that there are people who dig ditches and who are happy digging ditches, and they dig a very good ditch, and digging ditches is an extremely important job to be done. But obviously, you know, society kind of denigrates, you know, certain jobs and marginalizes people for carrying out certain jobs and extols the virtues of other jobs over those.
But there's no reason for people in those kinds of jobs to not be able to think.
Of course. Yeah, I mean, it's not about what job you're doing. It's about your ability to be able to process information and to weed out blatant lies.
It's the weeding out is what seems to be happening in ever extreme degrees. You've got extreme capitalism essentially being exported around the world, the sort of McDonaldization of the world, which is primarily stems from America, mm-hmm. Let's face it. It's provided benefits, but now we're seeing this sort of essentially psychopathic foundation being laid out throughout the world, where before it was possible to make a living, but now it's becoming so extreme that you have an extension of the rich and poor to ridiculous degrees. You've got a third of the planet living in poverty.
Mm. Of course, what do those people care about politics and about what's happening when they're struggling to kind of keep food on the table?
You know, walking 26 miles to get water every day.
Mm. And that happened. That happened by chance as well. No one made that happen either.
No.
Well, you've got a choice. It was either the corrupt politicians or it was some evil dominator god. Either way, you're screwed. Or it was just the universe, you know, it was just like nature, leave out God. It was just, you know, it's just the way the world works, but, you know, still you're screwed.
God plays dice.
Yeah. And he loads them.
With bombs. That's it for part one. We'll continue next time.